Ngoni is the founder of London-based women's wear label, We Are Kin. Her past experiences and fashion-conscious approach inspired her vision to create a body-inclusive and sustainable brand, something that she felt was missing from the market. Born in Zimbabwe, Ngoni fell in love with fashion as soon as she set her eyes on the beautiful designs that were featured on the fashion TV channel during her childhood, as well as being influenced by her mother's personal style. This early mesmerization inspired her to study a fashion diploma and then a BA in fashion design at the University of Northampton. In her final year, Ngoni was selected to showcase her debut collection at Graduate Fashion Week in London. In this episode, we talk about how Ngoni's mindset towards the fashion industry changed after seeing the destructive damage it was causing. Her mantra, people and planet over profit, is a key highlight of our discussion, focusing on using sustainable and ethical methods in the design and manufacturing process, as well as how emerging designers can play their part, even on a budget. We further discuss fashion's lack of body inclusivity and marketing for size-inclusive garments, and Ngoni tells us about life post-university with the advice that networking is one of the most important qualities an emerging designer needs. Ultimately, it's not always about what you know, but who you know. Overall, this mind-bending podcast focuses on real thought-provoking topics, as well as being so inspirational. Ngoni is amazing. She's a laugh, and we had the best conversation and the best time recording it. Before you dive in, we'll leave you with this quote from Ngoni herself. Do great shit, be amazing, and make the planet a better place. And of course, if you love this episode, please repost this on Twitter and on Instagram. Share it with somebody that you think would appreciate it. And please just tap us a 5-star review on Apple. It takes 5 seconds. We really, really, really appreciate your support.
Welcome to the Designer to Designer podcast show. This is a safe space created for aspiring and startup fashion designers entrepreneurs. Through this podcast show, I sit down with some of your favorite independent designers and give you exclusive behind-the-scenes access to their lives and brands. I aim to make sure you get to know the designers for who they are and finally engage with relatable stories. We touch on everything from mindset to finances to their childhoods and their biggest, wildest fashion dreams. This podcast is hosted by yours truly, Rebecca Tembo, founder of a self-titled women's wear label and the Entry platform which produces this show. Now sit tight, enjoy the ride, and get ready to be blown away by today's episode.
Ngoni, you were born in Zimbabwe and lived there till you were 10 years old before moving to England. Tell us about your early days, childhood, and the first moment you fell in love with fashion.
So, yeah, I was born and raised in Zimbabwe and I had a really lovely childhood. Like, I remember, like, climbing rocks and, like, doing BMXing with my, because I've got two brothers. So there I'd be, like, these big poofy dresses, like, climbing rocks, climbing trees, and just kind of, like, BMXing. So that was kind of, like, my childhood in Zimbabwe. But I really loved watching a lot of, like, the fashion on TV. And I think the first time that I ever saw something, like, really cool and fashionable, my mum was always quite a snazzy dresser. She'd always go to Mauritius and, like, buy clothes and bring them back and sell them. And so that's probably how I kind of was, like, first intrigued by fashion. And then there used to be this, like, channel with Fashion TV or Runway or something where you could just see, like, fashion shows all day and every day, and I would just sit there mesmerized. And my mum could see it coming. Growing up, I'd always wanted to be a doctor because I wanted to help people. And my mum would always see me watching, like, fashion TV or whatever it was I was watching with all the shows all the time. And she was like, yeah, okay. All right, babes. All right, doctor. And then I read an article by Harriet Quick in British Vogue about the trophy jacket and how she spoke about this jacket. I was like, I want to be a fashion journalist for about a month. And then I was like, no, actually, I want to be the one written about. Like, I want to be the fashion designer. And that's kind of how I decided I wanted to be a designer.
I love how your mum was like, by the way, you're not going to be a designer. Just reminding you, you're a doctor.
But she saw it coming long before. My dad didn't see it coming at all. He was like, what do you mean you want to be a designer? I was like, I want to be a designer, Daddy.
I absolutely remember fashion TV as well. I used to watch it all the time. And I was just so like, wow, just all these women and they're just walking in these designs. And you know, when you're so young, you don't even know the process. So you're just mesmerized with the whole, like, glamour of fashion. So no, I definitely hope they bring that channel back, because in my adult age, I've actually watched that every day.
Honestly,
that's kind of back. Yeah, and I have to go onto YouTube, but anyways, can't complain. So in a 2015 interview of Graduate Fashion Week, you said that what pushed you into studying design is that you felt like there was nothing out there for a woman like you. What would you say was missing at the time to serve a customer like you?
I mean, you probably get this as a Southern African woman. There was nothing that really fit my shape. I was always having to tailor trousers in at the waist so that they would fit the rest of my body and things like that. But also there was just like no ethical, sustainable like alternatives that appealed to me. It was very, I don't know, I didn't think it was very cool. I just felt like they needed to be more like that. You could make, you know, ethical, sustainable fashion quite beautiful, timeless, interesting. It didn't just have to be like frumpy. And then also it was important to me to have a label that was size inclusive. So I do a size 6 to size 26, but if you fall either side of that, we're always happy to like work with you on that as well, because I think it's important for women to feel beautiful, you know. And it's like, it can't be easy walking into a store and not finding what works for you.
And what is that feeling like for those that maybe don't have that issue of not finding their size or finding something that just fits, you know, the average society's like woman's body? What is that feeling like?
I mean, I was always able to make it work because I could sew, but even last night I was at dinner with a group of women, some of them in their 40s and 50s, and one of them, I was telling them about my label, and she was so touched because she was like, I'm a size 18, and I can't tell you how often, she's an influencer as well, I can't tell you how often a brand will want to send me something and they'll say to me, oh, we go up to like a size 20, and they think that's inclusive. And for them, for her, it feels really awful because like, okay, but if I'm the biggest size you've got, you're not really being inclusive. And for her, she was saying that her whole journey, like with body acceptance, was difficult because she could never find clothes that fit her. Going shopping with friends, even like in her teens and her 20s and her 30s, she would always struggle to like find something to, you know, when you do the changing on like thing with your friends, she really couldn't do that. And I think it has to be really, really painful. For me, I just knew trousers weren't going to work for me. But I'm also just like a standard size. I'm a 12 at my smallest, I'm a 14 at my biggest. I'm always going to, always been able to find, you know, clothes. It was always the waist thing, but even that, you put a belt on and, you know, it's fine. But it's crazy that fashion, especially large fashion brands, just refuse to cater to women. Because I'm not being funny, older women and plus size women be the most stylish because they also have like the money to spend, and it's like, come on guys. So
what do you think of the argument of when some brands say, well, they're not our customer, or maybe like they tried it before and they don't shop with us? What do you think of that as a response?
I think we've tried it before and they've not shopped with us. I have to like, you know, wonder, have you marketed it well? Because like I'm saying, the plus size community spend money. They really do. And also older women as well, because they've got the disposable cash. But what I will say to brands saying that's not their customer, I mean, okay, if that's your stance, then fine. But I think what I find more of is brands not knowing how they can like make their sizing more inclusive. I think that's more what I come across. I've never heard a brand just say that's not our customer. I just, oh gosh, that can't be good to say, can it?
You know, when I say that, I think of like Victoria's Secret and, you know, the whole situation that happened with the fashion show and stuff like that. And I'm like, okay, in their case, yeah. Not that it's the, I think it's the way it's said.
I mean, who is Victoria's Secret's customer? Because it's not even me. Because I'm like 32G at the moment, you know, like.
No, it's true. But then I guess with the whole like fantasy of the show, uh-huh, I'm like, okay, fair enough. I can see what they're trying to do with the whole fantasy. But then I think it's the way that they say it. Because if they do put a plus size model on that catwalk, like their brand will skyrocket from women, because they were basically, I think they were going into a lot of like financial issues, right? And yeah, they were so rigid. They didn't want to change. They didn't want to explore other options, yeah, i.e. be a bit more diverse with their casting, whether that's with race or with size, because they've always had this sort of like fantasy model sort of thing. And from one side, I'm like, okay, cool, that's your vision as a designer or as a brand, fair enough, because that has been the narrative in fashion for such a long time, you know, that skinny model. However, times are moving, times are changing, and you have to like keep up with it. So it's like, can a brand actually say, well, that's just not our target audience? Or is it like everyone has to kind of be on board? Yeah. Even if you look at like Victoria Beckham's website, like she only goes up to like a size 14, I believe. Yeah. And obviously I know her, I think her brand is yet to be profitable, but she still has money that she can, you know, always invest into it. Whereas a small brand, even with myself, for example, like I just recently launched my collection, and as of now, it goes up to a 16, I believe. But if you are a bigger size or smaller size, because some people, you know, emailed and they're like a size 4 or something, we can make that for you as well, which I think is quite similar to your business model. But that's only because I don't want to grade a pattern all the way up because I know that that's not going to be a good fit. And I know that requires like another sample and it's just basically the costing of it. Otherwise, it'll be easier to do.
It's fine for smaller brands, but in terms of larger brands, there's no excuse. But here's the thing, listen, if you want to say somebody's not your customer, listen, I'm really not here to preach to you or whatever. If that's what you want to do, I just, for me as a designer, I want to make women feel beautiful and strong and confident, and so whatever I can do that, I'm going to do that. But you know, I can understand, you know, brands saying that's not part of our brand's DNA, but your part of your brand's DNA isn't wanting to dress different women. I don't know, I just can't wrap my head around it. And I'm saying that with someone with, I guess, what you'd call size privilege, you know, like I will always be able to, like I said, walk into a store and get like whatever I want, but I just can't imagine wanting to exclude somebody out of that. But what I did always say, though, like, you know, coming up to people when they were like, why are models so skinny? Like, you know, the aunties and whoever else, like, why are models so skinny, Goni? And I was like, listen, here's what it is with models. Models are essentially clothes hangers, respectfully, for the models come to me. But with a size 6 model, I know that I fitted this dress. Any size 6 model will be able to fit in this because they're a certain kind of height, certain kinds of measurements. They're always going to be able to, like, make my clothes work. So if you're a smaller designer or you're working with a limited budget, it makes sense to probably have samples that are all like a certain size and make for a certain size, because models, you can interchange them. Like if I've got, you know, if I've got Christy Turlington and she drops out, I can get Naomi Campbell. I mean, I wish I could get Naomi Campbell. She's my queen, my mom. Don't tell my mom I said that. But like, do you know what I mean? Their bodies are very similar. It will always work. Whereas when you've got women who are, once you get to a size 10, you've got different sizes of size 10. You can have a size 10 with a big bum and like no boobs, one with both of those things, one with like boobs but not a bum. Waist is different. So I think that's where I can, you know, I always explain to people about catwalks, like it is fantasy, like you're saying, it's not real life. That's how you have to see models as well. I think a lot of people suffer with body image issues, but it's like you cannot compare yourself to a model because they're literally athletes. Like almost, you know, it's a different ball game. But again, I don't know, I just think, why would you not want to make people feel good? It's different when you've got budget constraints or if you're a smaller brand, like you're saying. Grading does cost time and money. And it's obviously great that you're open to also making those pieces when people want them. So I think it's about, this is sound really naive, but for me, it's about the heart. Like, where are you coming at this problem from? And if you're coming at it from it, you know, from a place of goodness, then that's kind of all you can really do, isn't it?
Definitely. Thank you. So let's talk about studying in Northampton. So you did a foundation diploma and then a BA in fashion at University of Northampton. So talk to me about your experience and whether you think it was worth it. Was fashion school worth it?
Yeah. Oh gosh, I honestly could have done with going to business school. That's what I could have done. I know that I'm going to start a business. Honestly, I should have been in finance and then I could have just like, you know, done all this in my finance career. Whenever people say to me, oh, I want to study fashion and be a designer, I'm like, do you want to be a designer, babe? Or do you want money? I don't know. But no, I really enjoyed doing that foundation diploma because every single day I got to work with different mediums and it really helped me explore my creativity. And then doing the degree at Northampton, I was happy I stayed at home because my other options had been Brighton and Westminster. And I just felt like, I was like, let me just stay home. And I won like a really big scholarship my first year of study, which really helped fund like, you know, my materials, my products and all of that. And just kind of like helped set me up. And yeah, it was definitely like a really, really good university, but I probably could have done with different kind of degree, I think. I think if you've really got the design acumen, I don't think you've gone to university, have you?
No, I didn't go to university. Exactly.
And we're in the same boat, do you know what I mean? So I think if you've got the passion, the drive, and you kind of know what you're doing, I think you can figure it out, because outside of uni, I've had to figure out certain things, how to make a website, marketing, all those different things, you know, outside of that I didn't learn at uni, so yeah.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, I always say it on this podcast, but you really don't need to study fashion anyways. You can study other things, but obviously there's so many advantages. Like if you don't know how to sew, how to make stuff, then obviously if you go to fashion school and you do a fashion design degree or diploma or whatever, you will learn the skill, which is really good to have just in general. But I just find that from the tutor's perspective, it's very difficult because it's like it's about whether they like it, whether it fits their aesthetic, and it can be kind of unfair to the student because you could have a really good aesthetic but one person doesn't really like it, and then, you know, it can really affect the way you feel about your work. But obviously the networking opportunities, you know, we'll touch on it in a bit, but you showcasing at Graduate Fashion Week and stuff like that, there are so many benefits to it. Even the scholarships that you got as well, that obviously really helped. Did you feel maybe when you first got accepted onto the course, did you feel like, it's not in London, is this like the right thing, you know, because there's this whole like perception of you have to be in London to do fashion, right? Which is obviously not the case anymore, but
No, I really didn't, because I mean, Northampton is literally where most of the shoes in the UK and it kind of in the world were made back in the day. Like, there's a real like manufacturing industry here, and the University of Northampton does have like a really good fashion course. That's why I chose to stay instead of going to like my other two options. And I was lucky that I made that decision, because in my first year, I think my mum broke her back, and if I'd been away from uni, I'd have had to drop out, because my mum is my whole entire, you know, life. If you follow me on social media, I'm always going on about that woman. She's like, please stop being obsessed with me. So that would have been like really difficult. And also, I think there's a lot to be said for being a bigger fish in a smaller pond than a small fish in a big pond. Like, I was still able, because of the influencing content creating, to have a lot of exposure in the industry as well. So it was okay staying in Northampton. I think if you're from a small town, staying there and doing a design degree, if that's what you're doing, might not be the best decision unless you've got that outside network. Like, I was in London like most weeks for events, or I was at Fashion Week, you know, so it was a different kind of thing for me. And I'm also quite resourceful and plucky. Like, I ask questions, where I think some people think if you get a degree, that's all you need. And it's like, no, you've got to work around that, you know?
Definitely, it's not just the degrees, the experience, the connections. Oh my gosh, that can literally catapult your career.
It may break you. My friend Abby gave me a location. Hair and makeup was done at the apartment during Fashion Week. Some of the girls who walked for me were models that I'd met through blogging. And so I come from a normal upbringing. Don't get me wrong, I was comfortable growing up. I still am. There's always going to be a roof over my head. But my parents aren't millionaires, you know? Yeah. So like, that show was very much like plucky, and I sewed that first collection at my kitchen table at my little flat in like London Fields. So network can really help you, because how else are you going to do it without bank of mum and dad, honestly?
Yeah. Do you think you'd ever move? Maybe if it's not London, it could be like Paris or New York, LA.
My dream, like, growing up was like, oh, I'll live in Versailles and I'll commute to Paris every morning. That was always a dream. And then it was like, oh, okay, fine. I'll live in, like, you know, just outside of London and commute to London. Now I'm in Northampton and I'm like, I'm actually quite happy to be back home. I wake up, there's birds outside my window, I'm by a country park, and then it's like an hour and a half to get into central. Okay. So I would love to. My ideal would be to live in Switzerland. I love Switzerland as a country, but they don't really have the fashion scene that we have. So
you never know. Maybe when you retire.
Oh God, I'd
or love get like that. A nice holiday home or something.
A chalet or two, you know, as one, you know, does.
Exactly. Why not? Okay, cool. So, what moment in time made you realise that you really wanted to focus on creating a sustainable and size-inclusive brand? Like, obviously, you study fashion, but yeah. Was it your goal to maybe work for, like, a label? Or was it like, no, I actually want to go and start my own brand, and these are my core focuses, alongside, obviously, showcasing your design aesthetic?
I interned and worked for quite a lot of people, and I didn't like some of the practices that I saw. And then also when the Rana Plaza disaster happened, I remember being like, because I was very much a fashion fan girl, where I could see a pair of shoes or a dress and my breath would be taken away, like I would be shaking. That was very much how in love I was with fashion. And when the Rana Plaza disaster happened, it really hurt me in that it broke a lot of illusion for me. And I was like, if I'm going to do this, if I'm going to be in design, I really want to do something that is not harming people or the planet. So I always say to people who work with me, people and planet over profit. It's really important for me to have those kind of like values kept in. And so that's kind of what made it happen. And then, like I'm saying, growing up, I always obviously had a body, but other women around me had, you know, larger bodies and just couldn't find things that worked for them. And I was like, okay, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to do it right. And when I first did the first collection of We Are Kin, I think it was like size 6 to size 16, because I just didn't know if like there was a market for like plus size. But I was open to that, and I made it quite clear, if you want more, we'll do that. And then now we're up to a size 26. People are like, hey, I'm a 26 and I want this. And it's kind of also happened gradually. It's not like I had this big ambition, just actually, I guess I did have an ambition to save the world. I'm not saving it yet, but I'm trying. But I think a lot of different things formed me to kind of get to where I was at, because like I'm saying, I loved fashion, but I realized that it can be one of the most destructive industries, and I just didn't want to take part in that.
Yeah, no, it's so true. I feel like now, especially for us newer designers. I mean, there was a conversation, I don't know if you know Priscilla, she is the founder of like Kim Dave, so she does a lot of like YouTube tutorials.
Oh yes, yes, yes.
She posted something on Instagram about sustainable fashion and being like a smaller brand and how it can be very difficult to be sustainable. Yeah. And there's all this pressure because, you know, there's all the panel talks and all that stuff. And you feel like, okay, I can't afford to do the whole thing, like where, how does this fit into like my business model and stuff, and how do I actually make money from it? But it's like, we also have to remember that as a small brand, we're not the problem, you know, like
absolutely the bigger brands not are the problem. Sorry to sound so vivid, but we're not, it's not us.
It's not us. We're not the ones that are causing all of these issues in the world. You have, like, if you've just started, how can you think that you are the person responsible for everything that's going on with climate change and stuff? Obviously, you know, collectively we can make such a huge difference, and there are things that you can do, even just the small steps from like your packaging or whatever, you know, just start off with and you gradually grow as long as you have the intention. But sometimes it's this, that sort of thing of like, you know, it's just, yeah, it's just so much pressure, so much conversation of you have to be sustainable and it has to look like this. And when you look at the sustainable brands, it's also becoming more like, in my opinion, like a classist thing sometimes. The panels that I've attended, you know, pre-COVID, it was always the same sort of woman speaking about sustainability, and her dress was like £200. I know, get me wrong, my stuff are not cheap, but even so, like, I'm saying £200 on like a dress that you'll just wear to work, right? How can everyone afford that?
Yeah. And so me, when it comes to sustainability, I always say it's about making, you know, small changes for a bigger future. So whatever changes you can do, small or big, do them. For example, I live in Northampton, so I compost. I grow my own veg because I've got an allotment. I've got the space. Somebody in London might not be able to do that, and that's okay. You've just got to do what you can do. Like, are you really like sorting your recycling? Are you really like considering your purchases? Because I mean, I'm all about sustainability, but guys, I'm selling clothes, you know? But I'm always saying to people, if you buy a piece from you, make sure that it's a piece that you really love, that you're going to wear forever, you're going to pass it down, and you've really thought about it. And I also make, like, big ticket item purchases. I recently bought a pair of Manolos. Not a sustainable brand, really. But I've wanted these shoes for literally over a decade. And, you know, I was finding out, you know, let me just make this plunge for me, because I know I'm going to wear them forever. Mum's probably going to steal them. My daughter will probably get them handed down. And it's those kinds of things where you really have to consider your purchases. And I think we really need to be aware of what we're saying when we're saying, you know, if you buy this, you're a bad person. Because, you know, some people can only afford to go to, you know, Primark or Zara or, you know, H&M. But it's okay, please just buy pieces that, you know, are going to last you. We all know that a Primark t-shirt, after you wear it three times, is going to have holes in it. So let's just, like, maybe not buy that. Save up, spend a little bit more and buy better. And also secondhand. And I do a lot of shopping my friends' closets, because I think everyone knows I'm a bit of a goth. And so I do have some print and colour in there now, but it's because anytime my friends are moving, I'm like, I'm going to pass by and, like, you know, get some pieces. And that's another way that I have clothes. And people are surprised when they see the size of my closet, because I literally have like a rail. And they're like, is this all the clothes you have? And I'm like, yes, because all the pieces I have, I truly love, and they're really well taken care of. And so sustainability, to kind of focus, is a lot of different things. I just don't want people to feel bad or downhearted, because we aren't the problem. It is the big guys, but we can also vote with our money and with what we say to them on social media and writing them letters and all of that.
Definitely. So how would you say, with like your core values in place, how is that reflected in your design process?
So my design process, some of the times, like with the fuchsia, you know, Juliet dress I really loved, I had one of my suppliers call me up and say, hey, I've got like 40 something meters of this fuchsia linen. I know you've done linen dresses this season. I don't know what to do with it. Why don't you just take it and see what happens? I took it and I saw what happened, and people really loved it. And so it's things like that where I kind of, I use end of line fabric. I use like fabric that I get from like certain design houses as well. And then also just like natural fabric. So it's like a mix of all three for me. So there is some polyester in We Are Kin, but it tends to be end of line, or I've got it from like a design house. Because that's sustainable in its own way. You know, yeah. Me going for organic cotton that's been like made by Uyghur Muslims who are in like concentration camps almost in China is not sustainable. You've got to find ways of, you know, being creative with it. And also, I'm a small brand, I'm self-funded, and that's how I can afford to do that. And so that's kind of the design process of We Are Kin, is I tend to have designs in mind, but also sometimes I'll see a beautiful fabric and I'll say, let me see what happens with this. And that'll be that. So the black silk and strappy maxi, I actually got that silk from like a very luxury high fashion brand in London. And it was like, I think like, like 60 meters or something. And I was like, it's a gorgeous fabric. I'm going to make this dress that I already had in this silk. Let's see what happens. And, you know, it did really well. So it's things like that as well, where it's like, sometimes the fabric will be what informs the design. Other times I've got an idea and I just kind of search around for what I'm looking for.
Yeah.
It's also cheaper than saying I'm going to get this like printed XYZ and then it's like I can't find it, or it's like super pricey. So it's good financially too.
Definitely. I've come to see that, you know, before it used to be a situation of I'd ask like, what's your design process? And I guess people kind of expect to hear, well, I'll go to the museum and I look at this painting by someone I don't even know, and then an idea comes to my head and I sketch it and blah blah blah. But even for myself as a designer, like sometimes it is just seeing that fabric and I'm like, bingo, got an idea, let's get this together and see what it comes, you know. I feel like it's just very natural, isn't it, the whole process. And obviously there's the whole like technical side of things, like your pattern, your samples, etc. But I like that it can just be whichever way. There's no right or wrong way with fashion, which is so good. So I mean, we kind of touched on it a little bit, but what advice would you give to a new cash limited founder who wants their brand to be either size inclusive or sustainable or both, but doesn't have enough money to do so straight away?
I would say make a sample and do pre-order. I still do pre-order sometimes with We Are Kin if I'm not sure how something is going to go down, or if I'm not sure what sizes to make pieces in, just have pre-order there. And you really just need a minimal viable product that can be one really well-made product that you put out there. Now that we've got social media, I think it's a lot easier to reach people now than it ever was. Like, you can reach the entire world. Like, I ship to China, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, like all over the world, because it's a lot easier now to reach people. And so that's what I would say. Just make something really beautiful and then do pre-order and have your friends push it out. Try to push it out yourself, and also just kind of be your brand's ambassador, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
It is really hard, and I can obviously like understand being a cash limited like founder or being self-funded, because we come from a background where you have to do it by yourself and you've got to make it work, and that money has to like come back and have made money. So yeah, literally get it made. And I think pre-order, what do you think? I think pre-order is a really good way of getting money into the
I think it's definitely a good way. I don't think people really think about it as their first option. I think they always think it has to be ready to wear, and then they get scared because of how much money you have to spend when you do ready to wear, which is thousands and thousands and thousands of pounds, if we're being completely honest and open. But I guess a question I'll have, because some people probably might be thinking about this, is how do you do pre-order? Because some people obviously like have a window, like Cult Guy especially, like they have like a window of time where you can actually place an order, then it gets sent to you next date. I think with maybe it's Moda Operandi or My Teresa, I think they only take the money out once the order's actually been shipped, so you can place an order but it doesn't actually come out of your account. So there's stuff like that. So in your with your experience of doing pre-order, like what would you say has been the best way?
And for me, it's just obviously we do like a 10 to 15 days, like that's when you get your kind of pieces by, and that works quite well for us. If you were to work with a fashion company like My Teresa or Moda Operandi, you can also get the money from your bank if you've got one. Obviously this is, you'd have to be able to prove to your bank, but you know, you're an actual designer, your brand works and that whole bit, to get that. And also if you get into wholesale, a lot of the time there's like 60 day payment terms, that can make or break a brand. That's when you kind of have to start being wise about who you partner with. But if it's just you doing it, literally tell your audience when they'll be, or your customers when they'll be able to get your pieces and pre-order, and that way they've got that date there. And because I think Maison Clio do pre-order, and they're on Net-a-Porter and all the big sites.
But would you say then that sometimes, because obviously there's made to order as well, which is basically very, very much the same. It's just that with made to order, it tends to be, I mean, Maison Clio, they're made to order, because I think her mum makes all of this stuff.
Yeah.
But I'm sure they have somebody else by now as well, because they're so big, they've grown so much. But it's definitely quite a similar business model. I just feel like there's this perception with made to order that it's just one person kind of like behind the brand, if that makes sense. But it's all the same thing, really and truly. But it's very sustainable, because you're only creating what's being demanded. Yeah. You're not creating in excess, yeah. and you can really control things. You can make as ethical as possible as well. Yeah. Like, no one's not being paid or whatever. So,
and I've also seen girls on Instagram who've gone to charity shops and bought like blazers and turned them into co-ords. That can be a way to like sell that, make more money, and then, you know, keep it going.
Yeah, you have to be so creative, especially with fashion. Like, people kind of think, I'm going to be a designer and I'm going to sell all of my designs and I'm going to be super rich. And you're just like, okay.
How it works, love.
We'll see. But anyways, we'll let them find out for themselves. So you graduated from University of Northampton and showcased your debut collection at Graduate Fashion Week in London. What were your expectations of life as a fashion designer, like, after university? And did any of those ideas, or like, you know, your thoughts, did it actually happen, or do you feel like it's very different to what you expected?
And it is a quote that says, like, the best way to make God laugh is to tell me your plans. That's what I would say about the dream of being a fashion designer sometimes. Really obviously loved, you know, debuting Graduate Fashion Week. It's like a big deal to be chosen, and I was like so happy as well because my collection was like obviously all black, and I was like, are they gonna pick me, are they gonna go for like zanier designs? But I kind of stuck true to who I was, and obviously I made it. And then life after university as a fashion designer, it's difficult. Getting a fashion design job is difficult. It's not about what you can do, it's about who you know. And I always tell people this, like, I don't want to make anybody not go into design, but I think people need to be told that it's not this glamorous, easy thing. It's a lot of work. And I remember some of the internships and even jobs I had as well, working, especially around fashion week, from like, because fashion tends to, in London anyway, you tend to start work at 10, but sometimes I wouldn't get home until literally like 3. Like, and then we have to be back in the next day for 10. And it was a lot of hard work. I really enjoyed it, but I've always known, I know who I am, I know what I can handle. And I also knew that choosing design meant there was going to be a lot of graft ahead of me. So I've kind of not been surprised so far on my journey, because I knew that there'll be beautiful moments. And that's what you see on the grab, you know. Yeah. But I also knew that behind the scenes there would be tears and stresses. And even now I still have like a network of designers that I'll call, like one of my best friends, Scott, who I met at like my proposed internship. I call him at least once a week now with my own business having a full-on meltdown, and he talks me out. And I do the same for other designers. And like I'm saying, it's beautiful, it's glamorous, it's a lot of hard work. And yeah, if my kid was like, I want to be a designer, I'd be like, do you, darling, do you?
I think the same. As much as I absolutely love fashion and love the process, there's nothing else that I can ever see myself doing. I would actually say, are you sure? Like, we can, investment banking, I don't know, like, let's go where the money resides. Like,
unless I'm a millionaire, then listen, I'm happy to nepotize my children.
100%.
I would absolutely make that happen to them. Because obviously you and I think we're a similar background, where we're coming from just like, you know, normal people who are great, but like, you've had to really work to make it hard. If somebody was to give me £1 million, I wouldn't be saying any of these things. I'm like, oh, it's so easy. I just go into the office, check on my, you know, my like design assistants, and like go home, and I do like 4-hour work days a week. So
basically,
everything's different. Yeah.
So talk to me about your production process, like who makes your clothes, and I know you make custom orders too when people request. Oh. So how early in advance do you also like design your collections and all that stuff?
Because We Are Kin is kind of like, I guess, not a traditional brand in that we don't do spring, summer and winter drops. I just kind of do like 2 or 3 drops a year, depending on how I feel. It's not a traditional design model, so I kind of, I'm always designing. I've always got designs like on the go, and then I kind of see the right fabric, I'm like, oh, yeah, you'll do, this is how it's going to be. And then in terms of who makes my clothes, I work with a factory in East London, so that's who makes the bulk of my clothes. I do make some pieces. I also make the initial samples, so I go to the factory with samples, with patterns. I say, hey, I want this. And then as orders come in, I'm like, hey, let's do this, let's do this, let's just do this. And for me, it just made sense to work with a UK-based factory because I can keep an eye on the supply chain. And also just to have that relationship. Like, I go up maybe like once a week and we have a cup of tea and we catch up, and it's like a real family thing. And I love that team feeling. And then I have an assistant who comes like one day a week as well, which is really helpful. And like I said, I also have designers who are in different industries, like activewear, couture, just like, you know, fashion design, who I also call upon if I need help. I think you need that. I would be lying if you'd say, I do everything all by myself, because no, there are people who, you know, help me along the way. And I'm always happy to offer that as well, because it's what's been, you know, done for me. And what was the other questions? Yeah, sometimes I make customer orders as well. So it depends. If somebody's just ordered like something randomly, and in like a, you know, a different size, then I might just make it instead of like being like to the factory, can you do this for me as well? But thankfully I can sew.
Do you have like all the machines? Like, do you like use industrial machines, domestic?
Yeah, I actually bought my industrial machine last year, like a sewing machine. So I've been using it like the domestic to do my samples. So now that's why I can make like custom orders as well. And yeah, I got the one where it's got the direct servo machine. So it doesn't make that crazy sound the entire time. And it's so fast, I can control the speed. So yeah.
Yeah, oh my god, because you know what's so interesting, my my manufacturers will, they will show me the difference between, you know, like a domestic and a industrial, because I've always used domestic in fashion school, because I did like a diploma, I didn't do like a degree, but in fashion school we had industrial, but I just hated how loud and quick they were, that it just always put me off. I was like, oh my god, putting the bobbin in, it was just like, I can't be bothered. But we also had the Singer heavy duty machine, so they're like basically right in between the domestic and the industrial. But looking at with my manufacturers, they have like every single machine known to man, obviously all industrial, and there is actually such a huge quality difference that you really wouldn't know if you've only used domestic. Just with the finishing, I think it's really just the finishing of it, where it's just like, oh, this doesn't look handmade. And I remember someone in a fabric shop saying to me, your goal should be that it should never look handmade if you're making it yourself. It should look like it was just somehow put together, like, you know, magically. So you mentioned in an article with Stylist Magazine that as a small label, we have found that customers want pieces with a story. Customers want to get to know you and feel a part of your brand. It sets you apart from fast fashion brands. What would be one detailed key piece of advice you would give to someone starting out on how they can best tell their story's brand to their customer?
Just be really honest and let your personality shine through. Like, I'm a bit of a snarky kind of like person. I'm a bit cheeky as well. And I think that comes through when I'm like, you know, interacting with customers or just like doing videos on social or whatever. Because people buy into you as a person. I think that's just, be authentic, I guess, is the key piece of advice. And it can be hard, but I think people can tell. I think anyone talking to me knows that I love my brand, I love fashion, I love, you know, ethical design practices and sustainability and the whole bit. And I think that resonates because customers know when they're being lied to, they're tired of being lied to. And I think if you're a small founder, people already wanting to buy into you, all you have to do is give them a reason, I think. So yeah.
Did you ever feel like maybe towards the beginning of your journey that you couldn't really show up on your social media or whichever way you like tell your brand story, that, you know, I'm the founder and like really just be yourself and show your personality? Did you ever feel like there had to be a certain look with how your brand was portrayed?
Again, this goes back to just kind of me knowing myself and who I am. And so from the beginning, I think the first post on Instagram might be like, hey guys, it's Connie, like here's my fashion show, or whatever it was at the, you know, the debut of We Are Kin. But I did feel like, are people not going to buy from me because I'm a black designer? Are people not going to buy from me because I'm like a size 6? But then I was like, nah, it is what it is. So the only reason why, like, the models I've used on my website, We Are Kin, the first kind of 2 or 3 seasons were people that I knew, so Georgia and Marin. Marin's like one of my best friends still. And so there were obviously like smaller models, even though like my brand went up to like larger sizes. That was kind of it. But that wasn't an image thing. That was just resources who I had around me. And I was always just kind of like champion having different, you know, kinds of women on the brand. So I think I've had like black, white, Asian, plus size and straight size. And then I would love to get like a proper plus size like model as well. But again, it's always about resources. Plus size girls are expensive, you know. Yeah. I did not realize this. I'm like, oh my God, ladies, I want to pay you, but I can't afford you just yet. But I know my aesthetic, if that makes sense. Like, I'm very much minimal. It's going to be black and white. I am bringing in colour now and print just because the customers want it, and I'm happy to give them that. But I always knew how I wanted my Instagram to look, how I wanted my website to look. I designed my website. And so, I don't know, I didn't really have any doubts, because I think if you're going into an industry like design, you kind of need to know your own mind. But I do understand what you're trying to say about being a black founder and maybe not being the typical fashion, having the typical fashion looks. Like, a lot of people do hide behind their brands, you know, for a while until they kind of kick off, don't they?
Yeah, I feel like definitely now it's a lot more like you can be yourself, which is so good. But, you know, with the way your fashion has always traditionally been, it's always been a situation of like, you have, it just has to look a certain sort of way. Yeah. The founder really shouldn't have like a brand themselves. They shouldn't, you know, with what you do.
Unless they look a certain way, yeah.
Literally, like, there was just one look. And, you know, I remember someone saying to me that, oh, like, just make sure that no one knows that your brand is black owned. This was when I was like I don't know, 18, 19. Yeah. And I literally took that as the gospel until obviously I grew up and I was just like, what the hell did that person say to me?
No, but you weren't wrong to take that, because what we were being told by the media and society was that message, you know?
Yeah. I mean, and that person meant well. They just wanted me to succeed.
That's what I'm saying.
No, definitely. So onto the deep personal stuff. I'd love for you to share a moment in time where you felt like you hit rock bottom and you were just like, I don't even know if I can do this, or I don't know if we've got enough money to pull through, or it can even be more than once, because I know that with fashion, like every week, there's something.
March last year, obviously, just as like everything was kicking off with COVID, I was about to launch Spring Summer and I was like, oh my God, like the world's about to shut. Who's going to be buying clothes? Who was going to be buying clothes? I literally spent, I'm very dramatic, I spent like 2 days in bed, like, mummy, I can't. Sorry guys, I'm just like the most dramatic person you'll ever meet, honestly. I like to complain and then get work done. I was really down, like really down, because for me design isn't just something, you know, I do as a job, it's my whole heart. And I was really, really down. I was like so upset, just like, this is it for my brand, this year is going to break my brand. And then it got to like just around like June and the brand just kind of like shot off. There was so many, and I remember calling the factory, like, listen, we've got loads of orders. Like, I don't know what's going on. And then it was just like a real, for me, I'm Christian, and I was just like, God really showed himself. Because I was like, listen, if you don't do anything, I'm going to quit, because I'm not doing this. I don't like to fail. I'm not going to flog a dead horse. And so like March last year was like a really, really, I think that's like the lowest I've ever felt with the label, because I just didn't think anyone was going to buy We Are Kin with like a whole pandemic going on. Who was going to go out? Like, we were heading into a lockdown and all of those different things. And I think sometimes with creatives, it can also be a battle of the mind. And I've never had that. I'm very like type A, get on with it. So when I have a low day, it's like, whoa, it completely pulls the rug from under me. So it was really difficult. But again, I think every self-founded founder will tell you that. On a monthly basis, you're just like, oh my God, what's going on? And especially when like you have to pay people and then the money is like, where are the orders coming? And then they come back in and you're like, wee! And it's just like that, riding that wave, honestly, is just, it's a trip. I'm lucky that I've got like parents I can call and like they can empathize with me and say, darling, it's going to be okay. It will happen, you know. And I was also lucky that when I left London, I could obviously, I lived at my mum's house and then I had a studio for a while with the guys from The Rest, Alex and Lewis. They also do all the videos for Slow Type. We're all from Northampton. So I shared a studio with them for a year. And then when our studio closed down, I worked from my dad's house. That's where my studio was. And I lived at my mum's. And now I've got my own house. So like, I work in my house. I've got my studio downstairs and it's all really lovely. But I always knew that I had a safe place to land and I always have to sleep. And I think a lot of the time people don't talk about their privilege. Just having a place where you can go work here and you can sleep here, it's a very big deal to creatives. And I'm grateful to my parents that, you know, I had that, because that there are so many barriers, you know.
Yeah.
For me, my barrier might be being self-funded, but I know that I had a roof over my head and somewhere to sew. So
I think that really ties in with like just being grateful and, you know, being able to show gratitude. Because there was actually a post yesterday by Refinery29 and they were talking about, I think, I hope I can pronounce the name right, Otega.
Okay, Ortega, yeah.
Ortega, sorry. The author, amazing woman. She's just written a book about we need to talk money. About money. And I think the post was about not being able to buy a house and seeing all of these 20-somethings buying a house. Yep. Personally, I don't care about buying a house, but I think it's a great achievement. My parents have a house and I'm just happy that I live in it.
See, you've got a roof. That in itself, I know, but we have to be.
I'm so lucky.
Yeah.
And we're in London, so it's like, thank God, because I know that I'm very much a city person, so I would have wanted to live in London anyways, but then having to pay like $2,000 rent.
And then a studio on top of that, what? Yeah.
Exactly. So very, very fortunate to be in that sort of position. But I was just looking at a lot of comments and, you know, how people are. I mean, I understand the frustration of it. And sometimes maybe if you're older and you're seeing people achieve that, it's like, oh, why not me? It was kind of sad to see people kind of complain about it. But a lot of the comments were basically just like, well, you know, mum and dad. And it's like a lot of people, it's not mum and dad giving them money, but it's just that they have that privilege of they live in the city or they live in their parents' home, basically. So they
having a safe place to get food in your belly.
Yeah. And maybe they just chose, I don't want to say the right job, but there are jobs, you know, in finance, especially corporate world, law, whichever, that pay really well. And they went down that path, you know, and we all make choices, and they just made a choice that would have made that sort of goal, such as owning a home, a lot more feasible for them, right? But then it's realizing, like, okay, you know, sometimes there's only one source of privilege, which is white privilege typically, but there's so many other privileges, such as just being able to live in your parents' home, having parents in the same country as you, whether you talk to them or not, at least you have something that can save you money, you know, like before you can go into the world by yourself. So I love the fact that throughout this conversation, you have mentioned it a couple of times, of having some sort of privilege, not feeling like the world is against me because I'm this, I'm that, you know. It's like, no, you have a lot already.
Honestly, even just having, like, my mother, both my parents love me a lot, and that in itself has given me a lot of confidence and able to go into fashion and have people who look completely different from me and still feel like I'm beautiful and strong and capable. I just think we are also lucky in certain ways, and you've just got to be grateful for that, because you can't compare yourself to these, like, millionaire or billionaire offended children if you're not one of them. You can only really compare yourself to you and just be grateful for the resources you do have, and also ask and reach out, you know, for what you don't have, because you, if you don't know, you don't ask at the end of the day.
Exactly. How do you keep yourself and then team organized to ensure, like, a smooth day-to-day operation of your business, to make sure that, you know, especially if you're doing, like, custom orders, or if it's like this pre-order system that you have where the customer orders and then it's made, etc., that just to make sure there's no mistakes and the customers are happy, like, how do you stay on track with everything?
I use Slack for my assistant and I, and then in terms of the factory, there are never any mistakes. I'm quite lucky in that, again, because I think a person of faith, I pray, I'm like, Lord, please, everything be great. And we've never sent out a wrong order, and then we don't really get many returns, because, like, our sizing is quite on point. I can probably count on one hand how many returns we Ockins had over, like, the 4 years that we've been going. But I think if something were to happen in that supply chain, I think, again, it's being very honest, being very professional with a customer. And for me, I think it's, I like We Are Kin to have, like, a luxury side to it, and so it's handling customers in that way. I also like handwrite notes for every order that goes out, so I also, that's like another layer of QC once things have come in and they've been packed, you know, I'm writing that note, I'm checking it as well myself and sending it out. And I think people will also always be more forgiving with a small brand if things do go wrong, so don't beat yourself up too much, but be as professional as you can be and absolutely give customers the experience that you would want to have. Like, we all know that when you order from certain brands or certain, like, they have Panetta Porter, you know, it's going to come beautifully wrapped and that whole bit. And you want to give your customers that, even if your product isn't like a £5,000 dress, you know?
It makes all the difference. That's literally why they come back to you, because it's just that.
They will keep coming back if you treat them right, honestly.
100%. Do you have anything that you do, like, on a daily basis? I know you say you pray a lot. Is that, like, something you do when you first wake up? Do you like to wake up at a certain time? Like, I don't want to say the word self-care, because I absolutely hate that word now, but just those daily rituals that make you show up for yourself and show up for Weekend.
I absolutely love me, and so everything that I do comes from that place of, have I loved me today? So I tend to wake up and I'll, like, read my Bible and pray, and I'll get on my bike and, like, work out. I've got friends who also, like, we've all got Peloton, so, like, we'll work out together sometimes, so it might be like an evening workout. And I just kind of try to get those two things out of the way first, because it kind of sets you up for the day. I go to bed every day, like, around 10:30. Yesterday I slept at, like, 12, like, 50 or something. And my body still woke me up at 6 in the morning, because since school days I've been bed by 10:30, up by, like, 5:36. It's a natural thing for me, so I can't give advice on, like, being an early riser, because my body, I can't have a lie-in. I wish I could, but I'm up and I'm ready to go. And and I try to eat well. I'm vegetarian. I'm kind of vegan, really, if I don't eat. If you don't stick burrata in front of me, I'm vegan. And I think that really helps, because it's another part of just loving you and taking care of you, because if I want to be this founder and work all these hours that, like, God gives me, then I need to make sure that I'm taking care of my body and my mind. So that is just advice I'd give to everybody, is take care of your body, like, take that time to love yourself, and, you know, you can be more productive.
Definitely. So what is the vision for We Are Kin? What do you really want to achieve? And this is, like, not holding back, not thinking, let me just say something a little, you know, realistic.
I would just love WeAreKin to be like a real sustainable and ethical powerhouse. I would really like to prove that you can start as a brand with a vision and still have that vision and that DNA, like, as you grow big. I would obviously love to, like, take care of my parents and my siblings, but also just, like, do great things for the wider world. Like, I really think it's important to give back. And like I said at the beginning, I wanted to be a doctor because I wanted to help people. I would love to get to WeAreKin, to a place where we're, like, massively helping, like, a lot of, like, for me, my passion is HIV and AIDS orphans, and also just kind of like battered women and children. I would really love to make a lot of money and have a lot of impact on that side of the world. That's my dream. Honestly, do great shit, be amazing, and just make the planet a better place. And I found it. Sounds really like airy fairy, but you know, that's the truth. No, I just want to.
Why, you know, not? If that's what you want to do. I mean, I think that's the dream for a lot of people as well. But then it's the fact that you get to do it in your own way, whichever way comes to you. So that's what makes it different. And who do you think you need to become to get there?
I just want me from 10 years now to be proud of, like, the moves that I've made. I hope that everything that I'm doing and everything that I'm saying, because I'll be held accountable to what all the things I've said to people, that I will keep being that person. I think it's in me. It's just all the work and also a lot of luck. I'm just a girl from Zimbabwe, you know. Well, yeah. I'm half South African, mum's South African. I've got to say that, otherwise, you know, she'll have a fit. But it's a lot of blessings. It's a lot of luck that will get me to the place I want to be. I think in my heart, I know what I want, and I just have to hope. Because it's not talent that will get you anywhere. It's really not, because I know so many talented designers who I've met who aren't even in design anymore, because, as we all know, fashion can pay a pittance. So it's not talent. It's just hard work and a lot of luck.
Basically, luck is real.
Like, the person seeing you at the right time, isn't it?
Yeah, but then you have to work hard to be in a position to even experience luck. So exactly. The two definitely come in play. So what advice would you give to someone starting out that you wish you had when you started?
I guess I kind of already had it, but be nice to everybody. Nobody likes a dickhead, and there's times when I've, like, met somebody and they've had a great experience with me, and then they've gone on to talk to someone else about it, about me, and then that's just brought so many, like, good things my way. Also, the press is a very small field, they all know each other, so again, be lovely to everyone, and not from a place of so you can do nice things to me, but just be kind, because this is what I think we all need, that, and work really hard. Like, don't give yourself these airs and graces about, oh, fashion's gonna be glamorous and beautiful, because that is a part of the picture, it's not the whole picture. There is a lot of hard work that goes on behind the scenes in any, I would say, like, industry, but with fashion especially, there's a lot of graft. It looks pretty, but it's a lot of graft, and just be prepared to work hard. Network. If you don't come from money, you have got to network. If you're shy, you better learn how not to be shy to get yourself out there. And also ask for help, but ask for it in a way where it, sometimes I get a DM from someone where they just, like, ask me, like, a super personal question about, like, my business. I'm like, you don't even follow me. No, I'm not going to respond. I'm just going to delete that. But there are people who were, like, you know, have interacted with me before, and they'll send me a message, and I'll help them out, because that's how we all grow, you know. So ask questions, but ask in the right way. I speak to all kinds of people, to be honest with you. You'd be shocked, some of the people that are, like, in my network or who I ask for help. But it's just, you've got to be out there, you know.
And do you feel like the time that you spent to kind of build your own personal brand, build your own platform, do you feel like that's also contributed to your success as well? Like, kind of put more eyeballs on your brand?
Absolutely, because some of my first customers were WeAreKin, people who followed me back in my blogging days. And so, yeah, and I think it also helps when things happen with the brand, that people have that access to me, and they kind of have, they know me a bit and know my personality, that people really stick up for me. With that scandal that happened earlier this year, a lot of people who followed me for years helped make it go as, like, viral and as, like, crazy as it did, because they know me as a person, they know I'm passionate about what I do and I love it, and they knew how I felt with what was going on. And I think, yeah, a personal brand can absolutely help. Absolutely. I don't think it can harm, as long as you're not doing a JK Rowling.
Basically. Perfect. Thank you. And where can our listeners find you?
You can find me on Instagram. Like, my username is Ngoni, N-G-O-N-I. That's my first name. You can find us on Instagram as WeAreKin. So it's at WeAreKin.co. Online as www.WeAreKin.co. And listen, just Google me, innit?
You'll find me.
You'll find me.
I'm going to put all of the links in the description of this podcast. But thank you so much. It was so fun talking to you.
So lovely finally speaking to you as well, Rebecca. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much for tuning into today's episode. I hope you're inspired to take action on your dreams right away. If you enjoyed it, please leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. This really helps us expand our show and reach more people just like you. Until next time, keep striving and thriving.